So we stopped at the gatehouse in Water, and I told the gatekeeper that I was interested in knowing where C.S. Lewis's quarters had been, but I had done a book on him, so I did have some interest. So the man very nicely showed me where his apartment was on the backside of the compound. And then he went into a bit of reminiscence. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, I remember Professor Lewis very well. Nice chap he was, nice chap. And then in very low-key British fashion, he said, "You know, they tell me he was rather well-known." And I said, "Well, I think you probably could say that." There isn't any question, I think, of what C.S. Lewis has been the most influential popular apologist of the 20th century. I don't think anybody else even comes within striking distance. I was interested in Lewis toward the end of my own doctoral study, after having encountered many years before, and not doing much with it in the meantime. But I began to ask myself, where I'd done heavy theology for a number of years, why was this Anglican layman, who was not in any sense a professional theologian, so widely read, and why had he had such great impact in the modern church? I was put on to this by a professor of mine in ethics, Henry Barnett, who had also been greatly intrigued by Lewis. And he said, "You know, I really think theologians have not taken Lewis seriously enough. And I think he's worth looking at." Well, I went to the library, and I discovered what I really had not had any idea about, and that was how many books the man had written. At that time, it was up like in the neighborhood of 40 books. And I didn't have any idea about some of his major writings. So I began to secure some of the books and check them out. I was increasingly impressed as I began to get into them. And I began to discover some reasons why I think he has had such an enormous impact. And I was interested in what he could teach those of us who tend to be more professional in theology about the apologetic task. But I've also, as time has gone on, become increasingly convinced that a mastery of Lewis is a tremendous asset to very average Christians who are not theological specialists, but who at the ordinary level of give and take want to be able to defend and state intelligently the Christian faith. So today we're going to look at some of his apologetic writings, but to understand him, I think you must understand C.S. Lewis himself. It is always true that any author is bound up with the work he produces, but it is uniquely the situation with C.S. Lewis. Would you mind me closing this back door? In order to try to get something of his own spiritual pilgrimage and his accomplishment as a writer, I think it's very important really to take a look at his life. Now, I don't have the body with me, but one of the powerful apologetic literary forms is always spiritual autobiography. And Lewis's autobiography is a classic now in terms of stating a spiritual pilgrimage. Many people have been touched and won the faith through this one body. If you're interested in seeing it, it's a volume called Surprised by Joy. And I'm going to, out of the context of that, simply talk about C.S. Lewis's life and the kinds of elements I think that went toward him becoming a very major figure. If you don't know much about Lewis's life, apart from some work you've read, but let me just ask you. How many of you have read something of C.S. Lewis? Okay, what have you read? Just call up a few. surprise was there?
Screwtape buildings.
Carolanda, the whole thing.
The space trilogy.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Till we have faces. Heaven.
Great divorce.
Yeah, great divorce. Okay, so fairly good sample. But it's interesting that many people who've read Lewis don't know much about his life. They knew he was a professor at Oxford and then Cambridge. Well, it so happens that quite apart from being a Christian apologist, it's widely recognized that Lewis was probably the foremost medieval Renaissance literature scholar of the first part of the 20th century. And he is widely known as a writer, quite apart from his specific Christian writings. The breadth of his writing is just breathtaking. It ranges all the way from his strict scholarly work, like a history of 16th century English literature, to studies in semantics, allegory, literary criticism, a trilogy of space novels, read at times by his non-Christian audience, and among the most prominent children's series of the 20th century. But it was as a lay theologian and apologist that C.S. Lewis attained his greatest fame, and it was for an unabashed version of Orthodox Christianity. Many of his 30-plus books deal rather specifically with the Christian faith, and those that do not deal indirectly. There's hardly anything you can read of Lewis's where the evangelist doesn't pop out at you at one point or another, sometimes in very subtle form. But his writings in defense of Christian faith and in the advocacy of faith range extremely widely, all the way from his very straightforward apologetic books like Mere Christianity or The Problem of Pain or Miracles, to fantasy, mythology, satire, children's stories, which are fairy stories or mythologies, and quite a number of volumes now of just simply collected essays that he either lectured on or preached on through the years. He had enormous prominence in the world of scholarship, and I'm convinced that has a great deal to do with the impact he had as a lay theologian and apologist. He was committed to Christian orthodoxy, as I indicated, but there have been a lot of popular writers who have been committed to that and not had his impact. Surely a major factor was his moving from atheism into theism and then into Christianity, and being able to state that in a sparkling style that's had few peers in our time. So all of this, I think, added to his literary ability helps explain his impact. So let's take a look at his pilgrimage, see how he moved into Christianity, and I think that explains a good deal about the apologetic approach he took. Lewis was born in Belfast, Ireland, in 1898, to a family of bookish parents. And his father was a solicitor, and that meant he was the first generation of a professional person within an otherwise a rather ordinary kind of family background. He spent his childhood out in a country home so that he was not thrown into large crowds or large schools or that kind of thing. It was a large home so that he was surrounded by spaciousness inside, and the houses were rather widely distributed in the countryside, so that the spaciousness and distance made up a lot of his childhood. And that combination of solitude and of spaciousness contributed to the formation of the early Lewis. It meant that he spent a good deal of time with his brother and lived in an imaginary world of books and childhood fantasy. In fact, at an age when most kids are playing cars or in this country cowboys and Indians, Lewis had an attic study in the country home, and he was reading books of great poverty, and he wrote a long series of stories related to fairyland, and then began to illustrate his stories. Can we help you? But we'll be willing to sacrifice them, won't we? But at any rate, he was very early in his life into literature and imaginative kinds of writing. At 10 years of age, Lewis began his education, and as was common in England in those days, was sent off to a boys' school. And he went through a series of these that I'm not going to go into, that finally culminated in his study at Oxford, briefly in 1917, at which time he went to war as an officer and was injured shortly after that, a minor injury, and spent the bulk of the war in hospital. He then returned to Oxford in 1919 and finished grades at Oxford. It was a great classic education in 1922, and then finished in the English school in 1923. At that time, there were no posts open in English, so for 1 year he lectured in philosophy. Now, I want to make that point because I think it's important to establish that Lewis was not a minor philosophical mind or theological mind. Because that may not have been his specialty, but he was no amateur, and he was good enough to lecture at Oxford in philosophy as a very young man. He then became a fellow in English language and literature at Magdalen College, which is spelled M-A-G-D-A-L-E-N. In Britain, they call it Magdalen, like you'd say M-A-U-D-L-I-N. But he began his career there in 1925. In 1955, he resigned his position and went to Cambridge to occupy the chair of medieval Renaissance literature at Cambridge, which was created specifically for him. He became an atheist as a teenager and became a Christian finally in 1929. Now, to understand Lewis's apologetic, you have to understand something about his own makeup. I choose to call Lewis a romantic rationalist, so that both in his own spiritual pilgrimage and in his writings, reason and imagination always go hand in hand.
You say
romantic
what?
Romantic rationalist. If I could put it in very pop terms, it means in his apologetic writings he tries to speak both to the mind and to the heart. During much of his life, he was occupied with trying to get those two aspects of his personality together, always with a good deal of struggle. So you'll find that in his writings, you'll have these rather straightforward, tightly argued pieces of work, like, for example, Mere Christianity or the Problem of the Twenty Miracles. And yet, he is widely known for this fantastic production of imaginative literature, I suppose best personified in the space novels and in the children's mythology called the Narnia series. There are many other examples of the same two tendencies. He grew up in a home that had no vigorous faith. They did have a prayer book and a Bible, but didn't make much use of them. So consequently, he really didn't have early exposure to a vital experience in the Christian faith. But they went through all of the outward motions of religion. In addition to that, His family was not very close. His father was something of a tyrant, highly emotional, unpredictable, given to excesses of relationships with his family. His mother was a very gentle woman from a long line of ministers in her own family, but religion was not any vital part of her own experience. So he didn't have these meaningful family and friendly relationships that have a great deal to do with shaping our whole personal health. There were also some emotional factors in his road to atheism, aside from this rather limited family background. He was given to intellectual pessimism, for one thing. And he later analyzed that to result from a divorce of his intellectual life from his romantic or imaginative or feeling life. And that in itself geared him toward pessimism. He also had a strong reaction to occultism. Occult, O-C-C, you know, too. During his growing up years, spiritualism, occultism, and theosophy have had a good deal of influence in England. And Lewis was in a strange situation of having a love-hate relationship with that whole occult dimension. As on the one hand, he was much attracted to it, and on the other, he was repulsed by it. There were a number of experiences he had with the occult. And in fact, his reaction to the occult was the specific cause of his movement to atheism when he was about 13 or 14 years of age. A person in the school he was attending was dabbling in the occult, and he just finally got turned off the whole idea of the supernatural and became an atheist. It's rather strange, I think, in our setting to talk about a convicted atheist at 13, 14 years of age, but that's precisely what it was. There was also a rational factor in his movement into atheism. He was, in one of his school experiences, was trained by a headmaster who was a ruthless dialectician, that is, a logical thinker. And he insisted that Lewis affirm nothing that he could not establish at the end of a logical argument. So that became a way of his mind tracking. And it so happened that the man who got him into this rational thought process was himself an atheistic rationalist. That is, a rationalist who didn't believe in God. And he said, you've got to have hard evidence for anything you believe. Well, Lewis did not find the Christian faith providing that kind of hard evidence. He also was greatly troubled by the problem of pain, a subject about which he later wrote. The problem being, if there is a good, loving God, how can he allow pain to exist in the world at such levels as it exists? And then he also, rather early, got into a study of religion. And he was convinced that by a study of comparative religion, that religions tend to cancel each other out, so that, in fact, none is really true. So there were imaginative factors, intellectual factors. Further, there were some moral factors. At one of the schools, Sharks, where he was at about the age of something like 13, 12 or 13, Lewis said he lost his simplicity, his innocence, and his faith. There was a young teacher at the school who had just come from London, and he was really with us, you know, really a groovy guy. And he knew all about the latest theater, and the latest dress, and the latest restaurants, and the latest inn things. And Lewis rather quickly got captivated with the idea that if you really want to be with it, you've got to be in. You know? So he adopted a rather pseudo-sophistication at a very young age. A young dancing mistress from the school also awakened his lust for the first time as an adolescent. And in a rather enigmatic passage, he says that Lord is a virtue, which he never quite fully explained as to whether it was really a sexual encounter at several different sexual levels, and this great deal of homosexuality, for example, in the school, or whether it was simply a lust of the heart. But at any rate, he learned what it is to encounter sex. And he just says he lost his chastity without any guilt or remorse. And therefore, he says, I am a convert. He said, I am a, he said he'd been converted from paganism into, from Christianity into paganism without any remorse or guilt. And he said he was an apostate pagan living among apostate Christians. That is, people in society who had fallen out of the church, but they didn't even enjoy the luxury of going as far back as paganism, which at least was still religious. His term, I believe, was he was a converted pagan living among apostate Christians. Then, in addition to the moral, there were some spiritual factors in this movement of atheism. Lewis had an almost congenital desire to be his own boss from the time he was a little kid. He valued individuality and autonomy, self-control, at a very high level. And consequently, as he began to learn a bit about Christianity and its transcendental interfere of God, he just didn't want God riding his back, in effect. That is, he did not want to, emotionally to have to submit his life to anybody or anything. There was an ecclesiastical factor also in the movement of atheists. At about 16 or 17 years of age, Lewis, in order to go through the motions, was confirmed and participated in his first communion, as he later said, in total disbelief. That is, as a person joining the church, but underneath the disguise was a real atheist. Now, that was his movement into atheism. Very complex thing. Family background, emotions, intellect, morality, spiritual factors, the state of the church in England, all of those things were into it. And there was almost a reversal of that process in his coming back to faith. Now, let me try to describe his road into theism from atheism. I've indicated already that Lewis is a romantic rationalist. And the romantic stream was very great in his later. He talks about a desire for joy. And he uses frequently the German word Sehnsucht, which translates roughly desire, longing. And by joy, Lewis means something like this. Joy is the object of his longing, is an unsatisfied desire, more desirable than any other satisfaction. It is an unsatisfied desire, more desirable than any other satisfaction. It isn't happiness that he longs for or pleasure. He says the desire for joy is like happiness and pleasure, only in that if you've ever glimpsed joy once, you will always want it again. And other than that, he said, you might just as well describe Sehnsucht as a kind of unhappiness or grief. Now, there were several things that happened when he was a boy that kicked off his first experience with the desire for joy. He saw a currant bush outside of his window one day as a small child, and suddenly kicked off a longing for something that he had never seen, but he thought more valuable than life itself. In reading some books by Beatrix Potter, he encountered the idea of autumn, just the bare idea of autumn. And again, when he caught that image, he suddenly found this intense longing within himself. And he was an avid reader of Norse and Celtic mythology. And in reading the ancient mythologies, he time and again encountered the idea of northernness, which again precipitated his desire for joy. Well, at various times, he would find that desire coming back, particularly when he would read mythology or when he would hear Wagnerian music. He tried to satisfy that desire with a number of different things. And as he worked on through his teenage and adolescent experience, he found that joy is not a disguise for sex or the occult or magic, and that none of those things can satisfy the deep desire within. Now, most of that time, he, as a young boy, he was trying to satisfy the desire in the things around him. He then got into reading Yeats and Meyerowitz, and in reading their works, it raised for him for the first time the possibility that there might be something beyond this material realm. On a trip to London, stopped, he was making a change of trains in a railroad station. He walked over to the book rack, and his eyes fell on a copy of a book by a little-known author named George MacDonald. The title of The Fantastics. And Lewis said that for the first time, as he began to read that book that evening, for the first time in his life, he encountered the idea of holiness, which was really a new kind of element in his own spiritual pilgrimage. Well, from that point on, he went to the war, and during the war, while he was in the hospital in Cooperage, somebody gave him a copy of G.K. Chesterton's Everlasting Man. Chesterton was a very great Christian apologist in the early part of the 20th century. And he said, for the first time, he really encountered the idea of just pure goodness in the writings of G.K. Chesterton, another new element in his experience. He returned to Oxford and began to read a series of works, and his philosophical reading was drawing him on now toward the idea of something beyond this material world. In addition to that, he developed a circle of very good friends, that is, friends who were good people, more good people than he'd ever been around before. Some of these became later very very famous people. Hamilton Jenkins, Orrin Barfield, a fellow by the name of Harwood. And one of these friends, by the name of Neville Coghill, pricked his reason hard for the first time. And what had happened was, a couple of friends had gotten into theosophy, which is a kind of cultist movement, and they were dabbling with the supernatural. So one day in conversation, Neville Coghill told Lewis that he was really captivated by the current climate of opinion in Britain, which was against the idea of the supernatural. And he said, you really have not critically looked at the possibility of the supernatural. You simply have assumed there is no such thing because that's the prevailing mood of the time. Well, that, at the level of reason, began to prompt Lewis to rethink the whole possibility of the supernatural realm. Well, very quickly on after that, the final crisis was precipitated. What he discovered was, it's very easy to teach idealism. It's next to impossible to live it. In other words, your judgment about what is of value cannot be translated into the way that you live. It was then again in reading Chesterton that he was drawn further toward some belief that there might be a kind of personal God beyond this natural world. Well, all of that process began to culminate. The reasoning Lewis and the romantic Lewis came together finally at an intersection. And in 1929, Lewis says, in a very calm kind of discussion, that he became convinced there was a personal God. And during Trinity Term of 1929, he knelt in his room there at Oxford Modern College and prayed for the first time. And he called himself the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. Well, he decided some way he had to fly a flag of faith. Now, he was not a Christian at that point. He just simply was a believer that there was some kind of personal God out there. So he immediately began to attend a college chapel on weekends and simply give some external witness to his internal belief. He began to get into a study of comparative religion. And as he worked through that and tried to examine the alternatives, he finally became convinced that all religion came to the focus of Christianity, that all of the ancient mythology, which had been the steady diet of his childhood and adolescent years, became historical fact in the incarnation of Christ. And as a result, he found himself moving almost inexorably into some affirmation of the Christian way. So he says that one day, not too long after becoming a theist, he and his brother got into his brother's motorcycle with a sidecar, and Lewis was riding in the sidecar. They were going from their quarters, living together, to the zoo at Whipsnade. And without any blowing of horns or any high drama, Lewis said in his work, "When I left on the trip, I was not a Christian. When we arrived at the zoo at Whipsnade, I believed Jesus Christ is the Son of God." There was no emotion, little consciousness of a decision, and yet the encounter took place, and from that point on, Lewis almost immediately became an advocate for faith. Well, I would say that a few motorcycle rides in the 20th century probably had as much impact, certainly on the life of the church, as that one ride to Whipsnade that day. But now look, that tells you a good deal about apologetics for Lewis. How do we come at the modern world? And Lewis says two ways. The rational advocacy of the faith, making an intellectual case for it, and at the level of imagination. He put it in technical terms. He said his rational road to faith was an argued dialectic, by which he means an argued logical process. But his desire for joy became an ontological road to God. That is, he called it a lived dialectic. And so he became an apologist. Now let me say a word about how he understood his role on behalf of the church. Lewis said that his apologetic purpose was basically threefold. First thing, to present the faith, the Christian faith, to unbelievers. And he did that with some hesitation. Because Lewis said there were far better theologians than himself who were far better equipped to do that kind of job. But he felt most of them had not been doing it. In fact, Lewis said that if they had, if the theologians would have laid off of controversial matters and had been directing their energies toward a presentation of the basic core of faith, there would have been really no need for him. So he was very much concerned about those outside the church for whom Christ died. And his Christian books, he said, were indeed basically evangelistic. Secondly, as an apologist, he wanted to defend faith on behalf of uneducated believers. In fact, he feels that Christian intellectuals have an obligation on behalf of their uneducated brethren. And he said that if we choose to be simple and ignorant now, in a time of vast learning, it is in effect to abandon conflict with the enemy outside the camp. And in fact, if those of us who are intellectuals do not have a willingness to defend the faith on behalf of the church, then he says, in a sense, our uneducated brethren really have no defense against the intellectual attacks upon the faith. And I think he is right about that. Thirdly, as an apologist, he wanted to defend traditional Christianity. It is what, following Baxter, Lewis wants to call mere Christianity. Now, by that he means simply a standard of plain, central Christianity. Lewis argued, and I think pretty much correctly, that there is a standard of historic Christianity that cuts across the Christian centuries and all of the Christian churches that is really a common sharing of all of those within the family of faith. And where you find it in individual places, it may be varied, but it is still very much the same. And Lewis said, if at any point he moved outside of the boundary of Orthodox Christianity, he did so against his will and without his own being aware of it. Now, you'll also find some of his works, he not only is a Christian, he speaks also as an Anglican. So the Baptists are not going to be entirely happy with what he says at a point. But that's what he's trying to do. Now, there are a number of things also that enter into this apologetic purpose. Lewis believed that his basic gift was intellectual, and that that was the service he could perform for the church. At the same time, he was quick to say, this is not the only way to present the faith to the modern world. That there are times and there are people who will best be won by a simple Christian testimony. That is, by a very simple, ordinary preacher presenting the Christian gospel in clear, direct terms and simply issuing an invitation to come to Christ. But Lewis said, there are also many people who these days will not respond to that. And those of us who are intellectuals can perform a useful service in evangelism for them in relationship to the world. But now, how do you do it? Lewis was convinced that apologetics does not consist of theologians talking to theologians, or ordinary Christians who happen to be intellectuals getting together in a kind of festering group of self-admiration and talking to each other about the intellectual dimensions of faith. He feels that apologetics ought primarily to be directed toward the masses of people, both inside and outside of the church. And that to do the apologetic job, one has to learn how to communicate. And consequently, he works very hard at literary style and at clarity of argument, so that it was his view, rather ordinary, relatively uneducated people will listen to an apologetic argument if you're clear enough and you go slow enough. But you have to do it in language they understand. Now, Lewis, on several different occasions, said that a major part of apologetics is the task of translation. He means by that, you must learn how to translate theological concepts and words into the common language of people. In a rather eloquent argument, one of his pieces of work, Lewis said, "It's amazing that we expect missionaries to the Bantus to learn to speak Bantu, but we do not expect missionaries to the English to learn how to speak English as the masses of people speak English." And he provided many examples of the difference in the ways that intellectuals use certain words in England and the ways that ordinary people use the same words. And he contended several times that he felt one of the major tests for ordination for ministers ought to be a test in translation, where they're given a text in heavy theology and are required to translate that into language that average people understand. And Lewis contended, if you couldn't do that, you ought to be ordained. And he said, the reason is that if you can't translate, you don't understand the theology in the first place. Or if you understand the theology, you don't have the capability to put it in language that people understand. And in either case, you're disqualified from ministry. Brother Harrison, I did. Well, you've got to translate. But he also said that you must be willing to preserve the historic faith without selling it out to the modern age. He had a number of targets for criticism, not the least of these being liberal Christianity, which he preferred to call Christianity and water. Well, that gives us a bit of background, and I want now to try to help you get a feel for some of this fantastic writing of C.S. Lewis. And we're going to be looking at some of his rational kinds of writing, some of these superb, imaginative kinds of writings, which in their own ways come at people from different angles in trying to do the apologetic task. I think you might find it interesting, perhaps, as to how I happened to myself get into Lewis. I was a sophomore at Baylor University. And early in that year, a series of things transpired that had very heavy impact on my own understanding of faith and my own Christian experience. My home church split. Some people whom I greatly respected had become guilty of some serious moral defaults. And a number of things came together until I plunged into one of the darkest nights of the soul that I've ever experienced in my life. A period of time where I would frequently spend an hour a day in prayer on my knees, only to find the prayers bouncing back down and echoing around the room, trying to communicate to God, and yet I could go out at night and look up into the stars, and it was like peering out into an infinite abyss of darkness. And Baylor didn't help much because it was a bad school back in the old youth revival days, and everybody was telling me how much they believed and how easy it was. And about the only response they knew to make to you if you did not believe quite with that intensity was to give you some kind of witness about getting saved. And that wasn't the question at all, because I knew very well that if there were a God, I did all that God expected for me to be a Christian. But the great question was there a God? So one day I was in conversation, and some student told me that he had recently gotten hold of a fascinating book by a professor of English literature over at Oxford. And he found one of the most stimulating things that he'd ever read. So I went over to the campus bookstore, and I picked up that copy. In fact, that's still the old plastic binder from there. The Screwtape Letters. And I went home and I began to read it. And when I finally got further over in the book, like about chapter 8, I encountered a word from God as powerfully as any time, I suppose, in my experience. And I found this C.S. Lewis fellow of Magdalen College, Oxford, very widely known as a Christian apologist, speaking in terms that I understood and speaking to me in my most desperate need of faith. I'm going to read that to you in a moment, and I think you'll see what I mean. Well, maybe you, to get a picture of it, you've got to know a little bit about the Screwtape Letters. How many of you have read this? Quite a few. It may be a little bit dated now, but it's not all that dated. Screwtape Letters is an ingenious literary device. It consists of a series of letters from a senior devil in hell by the name of Screwtape to Screwtape's nephew named Wormwood, who is a human tempter on earth. The series of letters is a set of directives from Screwtape to Wormwood about how to undo the faith of this young man who is the special assignment of Wormwood, who is about to become a Christian, then does, and you have a tracing of the temptation that goes on in this young Christian's experience from his conversion right on until he is killed in an air raid and is taken in the arms of God out of the clutching hands of the devil himself at the end of the book. And in the course of it, you have a moral inversion. It's a very unique device, so that by praising something, having Screwtape praise something, Lewis can condemn it. Or having him condemn something, Lewis can praise it. So that in the book, all whites are black and all blacks are white. The enemy is not now the tempter, but the Father in heaven. So you get a stratagem here of really getting out of our own normal dimension of existence, reversing everything, and you get a fresh look at all of our moral judgments that we normally make in life. And beyond this, you have humor coming through a humorless spokesman. Lewis's hell is a place of gravity. Everything is taken seriously. You could never laugh. You could never have any asides. You couldn't imagine a joke being told. It's a place of self-importance and self-protection and so on. So it's a very interesting thing to see life from the eye view of the Father below. And to have things coming through with a rather demonic twist. Lewis's hell is also a very interesting place. It's a marvelous bureaucracy to make the Pentagon look like a center of amazing efficiency. There are all kinds of corporate connivings and individual competitions characteristic of a managerial age, says Lewis. And you have really a police state, and it's a rather thoroughly nasty concern. In fact, it comes complete with all levels of executives, attempters, training college for incompetent attempters, attempters training college, and a house of correction for incompetent attempters. And he pictures this diabolical society held together by fear and greed and so on. Now, does Lewis believe in devils? That's quite incidental to the purpose of the book. And it so happens that Lewis, in fact, did believe in the demonic. Not quite as they're pictured in Screwtape, with all these little individual consciences running around, but the point is that he is really not talking about devils. He's really trying to throw light on life, but to do it from a different angle. And I think the value of Screwtape is not whether there are or are not devils, but in the uncomfortable probing it does in human psyche of laying bare the motives for life as we sometimes experience them, and helping us to know that whether it's a tempter or a temptation personified, there is a demonic twist in each of us that tries to detract us from the right path in life, and which subtly embeds itself in the motives by which we make decisions, so that at times we may not be acting quite as rationally as we think. Now, I think, frankly, this type of satire does require a reader who has a bit of a sense of humor. That is, if you can't laugh at yourself, you just get indignant. And satire, consequently, is not everybody's cup of tea, particularly for unbelievers outside the church. But what happens is that Lewis can use his literary form here to praise or to condemn most anything he wants to talk about. And you'll find running through the book a number of life's spiritual distractions and perversions being touched upon, such as the misuse of reason or the metallic clamor of an urban society or the interruption by hunger of serious thought as we begin to reflect upon God, or the stranglehold of fear and anxiety, or the perversions of pleasure and sex, or the undulations of spiritual life, or the suffocating conformity of modern society, and all that good. Well, it's a marvelous piece of work, and I still derive great pleasure from it. I want to read with you for a moment a passage that had enormous impact in my own life as a young college student. And I think you begin to get a feel for how, in a variety of ways, you can deal with serious apologetic problems. There's nothing straightforward particularly about this, but what has happened is the young convert, Wormwood's patient, has lost the first flame of the faith and has plunged somewhat into despair. And the background is that Wormwood is now turning handsprings. Because he's really sure that he's psyched this guy out, you know, and he's really got him on the slide to hell itself. But Wormwood's been around too long to know that, so he says, Screwtape has, so he says, "My dear Wormwood, so you have great hopes that the patient's religious phase is dying away, haven't you? I always thought the training college had gone to pieces since they put old Slug Glob on the head of it, and now I'm sure. Has no one ever told you about the law of undulation? Humans are amphibians, half spirit and half animal. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation. The repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. Now, if you'd watched your patient carefully, you would have seen this undulation in every department of his life. His interest in his work, his affection for his friends, his physical appetites, they all go up and down. The dryness and dullness through which your patient is now going are not your workmanship. They are merely a natural phenomenon which will do us no good unless you make a good use of it. And then he goes on to talk about how you make use of it. He says, you've got to understand the way your enemy's strategy works. The enemy, that is God, he relies on the troughs even more than the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. See, the reason is this. To us, a human is primarily food. Our aim is the absorption of its will into ours, the increase of our own selfhood at its expense. But the enemy wants obedience of quite a different kind. He really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself. Creatures whose life on its miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own. Not because he has absorbed them, but because he wants their wills freely to conform to his. The enemy wants a world full of beings united to him, but still distinct. And that is where the troughs come in. And then he goes on talking in a number of terms about how God gives us a lot of props when we first come into faith. But increasingly, he wants us to stand on our own 2 feet. And therefore, he pulls the props away. Much as you turn loose of the hand of a 10-month-old child as it's trying to learn how to walk. And so he says, in those first days of faith, he does a lot of overriding. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which, though faint, seem great to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest or temptation. But he never allows this state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later, he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the creature to stand up on its own legs, to carry out the will alone, from the will alone, duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trough periods, much more than during peak periods, that it is growing into the sort of creature he wants it to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumblings. Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks around upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and ask why he has been forsaken, and still obeys. But of course, the troughs afford opportunity to our side also. Next week, I will give you some hints on how to exploit them. Your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. Well, if you have not been there, chances are you have. And that's how I discovered C.S. Lewis. And what I found was an internationally known Christian who was just saying right straight out he'd been where I was at that point. And that affords not merely an occasion for destruction, but it was a creative opportunity for spiritual growth. And what he really said was, that's the way faith works. He didn't do it in any kind of dry argument, but he spoke at the level of imagination in ways that I guess I had not encountered like that up to that point in my life. And really what he was saying to me was, hang on, just hang on. And I did. And I went on with my prayers, and I went on to church, and one day, like you flipped a light switch that illuminated the universe, the God who had not been there was suddenly there. no blowing of trumpets, no feeling of emotion. He was simply there again at the center of my existence. But I found more help there than I could possibly find if I'd allowed all of my brothers in faith on Baylor campus to give their witness to me.